Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. It is just me and James this week. Everybody else has left us all alone, and that was probably a mistake. We're going to get a little bit silly, I think. Hi, James, how you doing?
I am well. How are you, Mr. Matt?
I'm alive.
Yes, that's a beautiful thing.
Now, we've got plenty to talk about this week. Should be good. So we'll have a bit of Hatsune Miku music, and then we'll get kicking. And welcome back. I lied a little bit. That's not actually a Hatsune Miku track. That's a Rin track, but same company, I guess. Great song anyway.
Kicking us off on the right foot.
Yes, we're off to a really good start. I've already made a mistake and we've got like 1 minute of conversation going. Anyway, so this week we're going to talk about screenshots first up. I don't know if listeners out there have played too many games, but with screenshot modes put into them, but it seems to be a thing that developers are doing more and more. Once you've got enough confidence in your engine to really kind of show it off, you're giving players the ability to pause the game in real time and then jump in and mess around with actors and the camera and all of that and get some really good screenshots of what's going on in the world. And it's a really good, cool feature. I'm really glad that developers are doing it more and more. The reason we're talking about it this week is I've been messing around with Horizon Zero Dawn for the last couple of weeks in anticipation of the review. By the time you hear this podcast, of course, embargo will have lifted and there will be a review up on the site, so go and have a read of that. But one of the things that really stood out for me was it has this most amazing screenshot mode, which is like having a full EOS kind of camera in the world to mess around with. You can apply filters, you can mess with depth of field, you can do basically everything with it that you do with an actual camera in the really real world, and the screenshots that you can get as a result of it are just absolutely incredible. I kind of wasted a lot of time in playing Horizon just running around taking black and whites off everything everywhere, because that's my thing with photography. I do like black and white.
It's a pretty amazing looking game.
It is, and it looks even better in black and white. If they had have done the whole game in black and white, that would have been something else.
Then it would have been called film noir.
Yeah. Which would have been cool. I mean, come on, a little bit of
creativity. Post-apocalyptic robot dinosaur film noir is a genre exactly. I've never heard of.
A little bit of grain over the top, and it just would have been the most amazing. But yeah, I know that you've played quite a few games that also have screenshot modes, James. So what are kind of some of your favorites and what do you like in, you know, taking screenshots?
Screenshot modes have definitely just become more of a common thing as technology has caught up with, you know, other forms of visual media. You know, it was pretty limited back in the day to, you know, 16-bit color and certain amounts of pixels that you could use and that kind of thing. And whilst that leads to some often, you know, some really great stylized kind of artwork, when you've got a photo mode or a screenshot mode in a game, then you want to be able to, like, show off, as you mentioned, you know, you want to be able to show off its best features. So, and I think as just naturally as games have gotten better looking and as things have sort of moved into the higher definition age and we're now sort of starting to look at the higher end of things running in 4K and that kind of thing, it's just become like more of a natural progression because people are more interested in how things look at a more granular level, and that kind of screenshots and, you know, specifically photo modes give you a chance to do that. I know, like, racing games have been doing it for a really long time. The Forza series has been doing it for as long as I can remember. Even things like moving replays and that kind of thing also kind of come into that, you know, hey, let's show off what our game can look like kind of thing. You know, I remember the old Gran Turismo games on PS1. It shows you how long it's been since I've played a Gran Turismo, but the replay mode and those were spectacular for the time. And then if you look at, you know, Forza Motorsport now and Project Cars as well, and basically almost any racing game will give you that that opportunity to get up and close and personal to, like, your car, or, you know, and sometimes you can even see the tires, like, bending under load and that kind of thing. And so it just goes to show, like, the kinds of details that, I mean, they wouldn't add that kind of detail if they didn't want you to see it, right? And that's kind of, I suppose, a video mode or a photo mode gives you the opportunity to do that.
Well, I think, I mean, if you think about it, one of the things that probably really drove this dedicated screenshot mode in games was the prevalence of social sharing of screenshots as well. Like, you know, the PlayStation 4 obviously has that button built right into the controller that lets you take screenshots on the fly. And developers obviously realize that, hey, you know, if people are taking screenshots of our games and they're messy with the HUD and, you know, it's kind of taken on the fly without, you know, being able to really control, you know, camera and all of that kind of stuff, the screenshots aren't really going to show off the power of the engines that we're developing. So that at some point, obviously, they all decided to, a whole bunch of developers decided to say, hey, you know what, let's give the players the kind of tools they need to take screenshots that really show off our own game. And then, of course, they're going to take the prettiest screenshots they can manage to take. And it kind of becomes that really useful marketing tool where the players are creating the actual content and then sharing it on social media.
Definitely. It kind of takes on this word of mouth, like it's a kind of life of its own quality in that aspect. which is
for sure.
one of the real positives that has come out of this generation of sort of sharing and, you know, sharing different types of media.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great because, like you say, it lets you kind of show off the real details. You know, I obviously play a lot of, for example, Dead or Alive. Dead or Alive has a great screenshot mode in it as well. And, you know, you can obviously, you know, when you've got 350 or 400 costumes or whatever that are there now, players obviously have their favorite costumes. It lets you show off all the details. Less probably said about some of the costumes, the better. But, you know, it's again, you know, the fans of the game love that. You know,
they for sure, it is, you know, it's, and that's like, that's kind of where a lot of this comes from, is like, it's wanting to see those details and, you know, be that, you know, the details on a particular costume, or be that like, you know, a really nice racing car or a beautiful sunset across like this insane desert landscape like they had in Mad Max, which I think that Mad Max game was, that came out a couple of years ago, had a wonderful screenshot mode. It's probably one of the best things in that game because it just showed off the vastness of that post-apocalyptic kind of desert setting.
Absolutely. And like, now that you've got, you know, Horizon's probably going to be the next step for, mm-hmm. you know, screenshot modes, because it does have all those filters and the ability to mess with depth of field and the ability to miss, you know, you can create wide angle shots to really capture the kind of the environment if you want, or you can really hone things in so it's a very narrow focus, so that, you know, if you've got a good shot of the character Aloy, you know, stabbing a spear into a robot, you know, you can really kind of get that granular detail as well. So this is a really good thing. I really like that the screenshots mode is in there. And you know, it's not just the big blockbusters either. There was a little Aussie indie game, Submerged. I don't know if you've played that, James, but
no, I've heard of it though.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's a fairly simple game. It's kind of like the climbing around sections of Uncharted minus the nonsense action, and it has a postcard mode it's a gorgeous game. So, you know, for an indie to be able to really show off the engine that way is it's really impressive. And I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, a whole lot more of it. I think it should be a default in any game.
No, definitely. I totally agree. But I think with regards to your point, like where this could be going, I think we've already seen an example of where sort of this idea could be taken to another level in Final Fantasy 15. And I actually wrote about this for another website not all that long ago, is that Prompto in one of the characters in Final Fantasy 15, his skill is photography, and he just takes photos of the action, as I'm sure, you know, many of your fans know. And I think that is just one of the coolest features in a game that I've seen in such a long time. And I actually really want to see that in more games. I think the idea of, because like, so if it was written in the right way, right, I think a system like, you know, a director or like an AI director or something like that could definitely figure out cool angles and recognize times of like action and or when something particularly awesome is happening, or like when there is, you know, something grand to look at. I think the opportunity is absolutely there to like capture some of these epic screenshots that like would take a really long time for people to, like normal players, to just capture that stuff. But I loved that about Final Fantasy 15 at the end of the day, where you just sat down and went through 10 of your best or 11 of your best images, and you could pick out your best ones and save them for later. And whilst, you know, they weren't always great, that's not the point. Some of them came out absolutely incredibly. I remember one shot, I didn't play a whole bunch of Final Fantasy 15. I kind of fell off it, but I gave it a good like 10 hours or so. And I remember getting down to that beach sort of pier section, and there's a wonderful shot of where I was fishing, and the sun was going down. It was like a really deep sunset, but it was a really close shot silhouette of Noctis and the pier in the background. Yeah, it was just a that's when it kind of hit me that, you know, something like that has some real potential. And I think if developers spend a little bit more time sort of honing that kind of idea, they could really put it to good use, and it would do not just their game, but an advantage. But I mean, you know, that kind of stuff is really fun to share as well.
And welcome back. That was some music from Morrowind, which, whether you like the Elder Scrolls games or not, you have to admit that that soundtrack is just absolutely spectacular.
It's wonderful.
Yep. Work of art. I actually, before we start talking about the next thing, I actually went to one of those concerts, video game concerts, and that was one of the tracks that was played by Symphony, and it was just breathtaking. Even my wife, who is not into console games so much, or hasn't been until she kind of met me anyway, even she was like, what game's that from? And
yeah. I need to play this now. Get it in my life.
Yeah. So, yeah. Awesome, awesome soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, DLC is what we're going to talk about this time around. It's kind of an ongoing discussion, I guess, that people have been having ever since DLC was invented. Whether... it's a good thing for games, whether it's anti-consumer or whatever you want to call it, whether it's necessary. And, you know, that's something we haven't really talked about on the podcast before. So we thought we'd give it a crack now and see if we can get through without beating one another to death. I know that everybody on the DDNet team has different opinions about DLC and where their kind of tolerance threshold is for it. So, for me, before we get James's opinion on it, I guess for me, I'm generally a fan of DLC because I think it kind of offers the opportunity to extend the life of a game. If I go back to, again, Dead or Alive, because it's just such an overt example of DLC. But the reason that Dead or Alive 5 has kind of lasted as long as it has, and they keep adding new characters and new stages and all kinds of stuff, is because they keep, you know, bringing money in through DLC. And the good thing I think for that is, for the most part, you could argue the characters are kind of necessary to having a complete game. But the costumes and things like that, it's all completely superficial to the game. It's all completely optional. You don't really have to buy any of it if you're not interested in it. And you know, for me, that's a good example of DLC. I think that's a good thing. Where I kind of don't like DLC is when it starts to get to the point where the game itself has bits and pieces carved off it to sell as DLC later on. Ubisoft's probably the famous example of doing that quite a bit, sticking content behind DLC or pre-order bonuses or whatever. And, you know, you don't get the complete game as a result. I don't like it when that happens. If you're going to do important content to the game, I believe you should kind of, as a developer, you should hold until you've got enough content to kind of turn it into what you'd probably better term as an expansion pack, which, you know, the Souls games or The Witcher are great examples of, where they have, you know, 6 months after the game itself is released, there's a meaty release of content, which adds to, you know, the existing experience, as opposed to being a little bit of content that's carved off the main game, like a mission or two. So those are my kinds of thoughts about DLC in general. I'm not sure where you sit on all of that, James. You probably disagree with me.
No, actually, I mean, I could be totally totally boring and just say, hey, I completely agree with you. But I'll elaborate a little bit more than that. Because I do, for the most part, agree with you. I think DLC is a good thing. And I think the idea that DLC is anti-consumer is laughable because it's giving the people more of what they want. If DLC wasn't a popular thing, if people didn't buy DLC, then it would have gone away many years ago. And the fact is that it works, people love it, people buy it, and it doesn't matter if people jump up and down on the internet about it. People will always continue to buy DLC as long as your game is good. So now that we've gotten that out of the way, you do need to sort of come at this wider conversation with a little bit of nuance, because there is some shady shit that goes on with DLC. And it does come in exactly the form that you describe it, in that, you know, I don't know, I suppose Destiny seems like the most apt example that I can think of. I know it's an old game at this point, but it's kind of low-hanging fruit, I guess. It's a perfect example of a game that felt like it could have been so much more, but it had a whole bunch of it just ripped out at some point. And I don't think that they ever really put it back in through DLC in the first place. But I mean, DLC is also the only reason that that game is up to a place where you can play it, where it's worth playing now. Back when it came out, it certainly was not, you know, up to the standard by which Bungie's games usually are. And it was through DLC that that game came up to being like the thing that it is today, you know, a game worth playing. It's the same with like Diablo 3 has changed remarkably over the years thanks to just ongoing development and Blizzard's dedication to that game, and like that's why that game has had a continued life for so long. I mean, it's how old at this point? Like, it's got to be closer to a decade old at this point. And it's still going strong. They're talking about bringing this season stuff to consoles. That release in itself completely revitalized that entire community. To the point where now we're hearing a lot of murmur about when is Diablo 4 coming. But then you also run into situations like, you know, Bethesda's bullshit with the Fallout 4 DLC or that season pass, you know, where at first they were selling the season pass without telling anybody what was going to be in it, and then changing the content of the season pass after people had already bought it, and the value of that thing has changed over time as they have changed their plans. And I mean, you know, I suppose in one sense that's going to happen from a business perspective because plans change. But from a consumer perspective, that's what I would call anti-consumer in terms of DLC, is that just a lack of clearness in the messaging from the beginning. That's kind of where I fall on that, you know. And I mean, I don't play a whole lot of DLC anyway. mostly because I mean, being a games writer, I have to try and keep up with everything that's going on, and that means playing as many different games as I possibly can. So, you know, it doesn't always afford me the time to go back and revisit, you know, the latest DLC. Even if it's for a game that I particularly like, you know, I really like Just Cause 3, and I really wanted to play a bunch of that DLC when it came out because it added a whole bunch of really cool stuff. You know, just the nature of the beast is that you know, I don't have that time. So, that's kind of where I fall in the DLC argument, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, some of those examples that you mentioned, I haven't really played. I wasn't really aware of what was going on with Fallout and all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I do generally agree with you. In terms of, yeah, you know, other good examples of DLC, just thinking while you were talking a bit there as well, you know, Zen Pinball, the pinball tables, a good example of DLC. You know, if you download the base package, you if anything at all, I can't remember if it's a free to download base game with like one table or it's like a dollar or two. But anyway, then you kind of pick and choose which tables you're interested in and just kind of download them. And again, you know, the success of the DLC has meant that Zen Studios has been able to continue producing more and more and more of these tables without much of a break. So,
and that's the important thing to remember here, I think, is that, you know, for a lot of modern day development, that like DLC is their lifeline. Like that is what is keeping these companies propped up, is just that that's what's creating their ongoing stream. Because like, I think of what a lot of people don't realize is when, you know, a game comes out, there is that's a rush of money that comes in via sales. And then that kind of stops. When that goes away, that money stops coming in, you know, and unless you're a studio that's backed by a publisher that has money that is going to, you know, either advance you or whatever, then, or you have, you know, some kind of a cool deal with whatever, without that backing, you're facing the very real prospect of having to close your studio and not being able to make your games anymore. So, you know, that's a very real thing. And a very real reason why DLC exists in its current form.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to note there is that because of the DLC, I mean, DLC largely, especially in the AAA space these days, DLC actually subsidizes the cost of the base game. There's a lot of publishers in that really top-end stuff, like the EAs and Activisions, with their marquee titles like FIFA and Call of Duty, that essentially sell the base games at no margin or even, you know, a small loss, kind of loss-leading exercise, and then recoup that money on the DLC. So, for instance, FIFA, the game that you're buying when you pay, you know, $100 Australian for it is not worth $100. It's actually, you know, if you're to pay what you needed to subsidize the cost of development or to return the cost of development, you'd actually need to pay a lot more than $100. But because people get really stuck into the, you know, ultimate team mode and all that kind of stuff and buy the packets of cards and that from within the game, EA is able to sell the base game to people who aren't particularly interested in that feature cheaper. So, you know, it's cost of development's going up. Games are cheaper now relative than they've kind of ever been. And I think people should be aware that, you know, DLC has a really important purpose in helping to keep those costs down by allowing the people that are really into the games to effectively subsidize the cost for people who are not quite so into those games.
Totally. But I think it's just one last point. It's important to note that even with that in mind, that doesn't mean that we don't call out bad DLC or crappy business practices, because that's something that still needs to be called out and stamped out. Yeah, it is important to remember just how important it is to the sort of life cycle of a studio. We'll be right back.
And welcome back. We were talking a little bit about Final Fantasy beforehand, so I decided to throw in some Final Fantasy music. And that was Waltz to the Moon from Final Fantasy VIII, a very underrated Final Fantasy. People tend to forget about that one now, not least because Square Enix seems to have forgotten about that one. For some reason, you can get Final Fantasy VII and IX on your iPad, but not VIII, which is just nuts.
It's no room for Gollum, Rinoa.
Yeah, yeah. No, unfortunately. Selfie and Rinoa.
Yeah.
First Final Fantasy waifus. Okay. So to kind of circle back a little bit, because I want to keep talking about Horizon in a roundabout way, we thought we'd talk about open world games for the last section of our podcast this week. If you look at, I guess, trends in the industry, last generation, it was all about the shooter. The shooter was kind of the dominant genre. And if a developer or publisher was looking to do a new big AAA blockbuster, whatever, they'd immediately turn to the shooter genre. It looks like open world games are kind of the new thing. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because I happen to think that open world games are a particularly tricky beast, and I don't think the industry necessarily handles them so well a lot of the time. I will leave the discussion. I'll leave the discussion about Horizon as an open world game to my review. But in short, it's problematic in a sense. I don't think it necessarily needed to be as open world as it is. And I think that's kind of, that applies to quite a few open world games. The obvious Watch Dogs 2, a lot of Ubisoft's ones actually. Assassin's Creed, for the most part, don't need to be open world, I don't feel. I mean, if you look at Assassin's Creed, what's great about it, the hook of those games is always the way that they appropriate history and the way that they present history, and they present these amazing landmarks for these great set pieces. And
that I'll agree with. I don't think they're good games, but I'll agree with that.
Well, I mean, that's my hook. I'm a big history buff, so I kind of get into the Assassin's Creed games because they present history in an interesting way. And if you look at them, I mean, aside from when you're running from one landmark to the next, you're kind of just running through boring cities doing the same thing over and over again. And I think Ubisoft would have been much better having a very focused game that was more linear in design, and then just made those set pieces and those major buildings and pieces of architecture the actual focus of the game.
So I feel the thing with Ubisoft is that they've actually gotten really good at making like nice looking open worlds. And I think that kind of culminated with Watch Dogs 2. And, you know, in that city was that open world San Francisco was really varied and interesting to actually walk around. But the problem is that, like you say, it was filled with a lot of the Ubisoft open world tropes. I mean, it didn't quite have, you know, climbable towers or anything like that, but it was filled with a bunch of pointless collectibles and like side missions that weren't necessarily that great.
And that's always the sign of a developer that's got an open world and then doesn't really know what to do with it. Exactly. So they feel like they need to fill it out with stuff, mm-hmm. and that stuff is never worth doing. And I think that's a problem that it's not just exclusive to Ubisoft. I'm probably going to get slaughtered for saying this, but I think the Batman games were better off when they weren't open world. You know, when they were more focused again on specific areas and then making those areas really showcase the strengths and strengths and creativity of the development team.
I suppose that's like, it's almost like a problem by nature of the open world itself, in that they seem a little bit directionless, is because like a big, I suppose, tentpole of the open world game is that player freedom and player agency. And without that, you know, it's, how do you, like, I'm trying to think of, you know, an open world game that was kind of pretty linear in the way that it drove you around. And I'm thinking of L.A. Noire.
It's not so much the linearness that makes a good open world game. If the developer is able to drive you from place to place, then whatever. But for me, what makes an open world game a good example of an open world is where the world itself is actually the game.
For sure. Yeah, that's true. That's, yeah.
You know, I'm not a huge fan. I'm not the biggest fan in the world of Rockstar, but one thing I definitely give them credit for is that they make the cities in their GTA games, and they make the American wilderness in Red Dead Redemption the actual game. Like it's not just a place where there's a character running around and doing stuff. It's an actual. It's almost like a character in itself. It has a story, and it's got a personality.
It definitely is, and I think a lot of that comes back to your first point of there being a point to that stuff existing. You know, it's not just an afterthought. It's something that has been thought about and poured over and changed and rewritten again and again until, you know, you can tell it's been worked on because it fits into the grain of the world and it fits into the narrative of the world itself. You know, it feels natural that it's there and it makes sense and it doesn't feel like something that's entirely alien and out of place. And you can kind of tell when, like, humans are really good at telling when something doesn't fit. And, you know, when you stick kind of oddball open world mechanics into, like, something, you know, like if you're trying to make a super realistic world, but then you throw in all of this super weird shit that doesn't make sense, you know, it's kind of that kind of diametrically opposed positioning just makes your game seem like weird. It makes it seem at odds with itself sometimes, unless that's like a part of the style that you're going for, like a Saints Row or something like that. But or like even a, you know, to a lesser extent, Yakuza Zero, which kind of feeds on that really stylized but quite realistic looking open world. In a way that's super stylized and it really works.
I think Yakuza Zero is a brilliant example of an open world or what an open world should kind of aspire to be, because it's not bloated. It's only, if you were to put the world of Yakuza Zero into one of Ubisoft's games, it would be like this tiny corner of a map. It doesn't take up, the spaces aren't that big, but they're big enough for what Sega needs to do, which is they want to create this atmosphere of, you know, a living, breathing city, to kind of a city playground to run around in and play in. And because it is focused, because it's concentrated into a smallish area, there's not that perception that this, you know, boring stuff just filling, you know, space and time between the missions. You know, you're constantly doing stuff. You're constantly exploring and you're constantly coming across kind of new and vibrant things to do.
It helps tighten up the pacing as well, I think.
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of what I was getting to. The pacing of open world games is often way out of whack. Like, and you know, this applies to even some of the best examples. I think The Witcher 3 is a brilliant game. Treatment and all that kind of stuff. I think it is a brilliant game, but one of the things I wasn't huge on was just I didn't feel like that open world was particularly engaging. I thought it was a fairly standard fantasy world, and all the stuff that I was enjoying about Witcher 3 was the stuff when I wasn't just riding on horseback from one spot to the next. You know, I would like to see developers understand that an open world that doesn't have stuff going on that's meaningful is just not worth doing in the first place.
I'm kind of willing to give Witcher 3 a pass in that I feel like its world had such a rich backstory that everything that was going on there made sense. You know, like obviously if you weren't interested in that backstory, then you would probably feel the same way that you do. And, you know, but I feel like, you know, like Velen, that kind of area was all completely like battle torn and messed up. And that was, you know, it was emptied largely for that reason. And I felt like they backed that up with a really rich kind of the richness of their story. Where I will dock The Witcher 3 is I think that their pacing was entirely out of whack. But that was more to do with some of the BS sort of half side quests that they would send you off that were actually story missions. But, you know, that's probably a chat for another time.
Well, I mean, to compare to, for me, if you look at the Souls games, they're all effectively open worlds.
They're wonderful open worlds too.
They're wonderful open worlds, but they're also focused in design in that they are constantly driving you somewhere, and the movement from one space to the next is constantly filled with stuff. And I find that a lot more engaging.
Those games draw you in, you know. There is an air of mystery about those games that makes you want to go further in those worlds. And they just sort of keep... It's a bit like walking down that hallway that just sort of keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And you just want to keep going because you want to figure out what's at the end.
Well, again, it's because the world itself is kind of a character within the drama. You know, the world has meaning. And I think too many open world games don't. I guess just to wrap things up, because we wrapped things up with Final Fantasy in a previous section of the podcast, I do want to mention the open world for Final Fantasy 15, which is a little bit amusing because despite being everything I just complained about with open worlds, I found that one to be particularly effective. And the reason for it was, funny enough, for me, one of the things I love most about Final Fantasy 15 was just kind of sitting in the car, even setting it onto autopilot. So I wasn't actually interacting with it anyway, in any way, but just kind of watching the characters drive, because it was kind of that road trip vibe. Mm-hmm. And even though there was nothing in this open world, Square Enix was really kind of brilliant in making the details of that kind of journey through the space part of the overall experience. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people started fast traveling and stuff like that in Final Fantasy 15, and they lost a little bit of that experience as a result. I think Square Enix probably should have not had fast travel in that one at all, because as dull as that world was, or in terms of conventional sense of action, as dull as it was, that those kinds of small moments in the car where, you know, the characters are talking to each other, or you're just listening to Final Fantasy music, or there's something happening, you know, in the far background, the wildlife are fighting each other or whatever. Those kinds of moments kind of built, you know, quite an interesting world, I felt.